Let me ask you a little question. Is your business already doomed to failure just because you chose the wrong strategy? I can tell you from experience, if you choose the wrong strategy from the start, and I'm not talking real estate investment strategy, I'm not talking strategy on growing your company, I'm talking your overall wealth building strategy and how your company fits into that long term. Have you chosen the wrong one? Is that going to lead you down a path to make you unhappy in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years? Is that going to lead you down a path to make a bunch of money, but lose all of your time, lose all of that freedom that you're looking for as an entrepreneur? Well, on today's episode of the Carrot Cast, I have a good friend of mine, Daniel Clayman, who is a crazy active investor. He has an amazing story, by the way. Grew up in Russia for part of his life. His parents immigrated over to the U.S. and then he started out in finance. You guys are going to hear how he got caught up and kind of flushed out in the financial downturn in 2008 on Wall Street, how that led to him following real estate down to Virginia. And now he's crushing it in Richmond, Virginia. He owns over 70 units himself that he's acquired. He is doing lots of land deals, buying and doing new construction. He's in commercial projects now, and he's got about $5 to $7 million in new projects under the works right now, in addition to the 70 plus units he currently owns. How does someone go from scratch, go from little to no experience in real estate, and very, very purposefully and methodically build up a portfolio of properties with a very specific strategy to help lead him toward ultimate happiness, toward his ultimate goals, toward a diversification as far as making sure that he's not getting caught up in the house flipping craze that everyone is right now, where a lot of people are paying way too much for property, just like they were in 2005, 2006, and 2007. How do you go out there and be methodical and purposeful in your business model to make sure it's going to lead you toward happiness? A lot of house flippers and wholesalers out there, I can guarantee you, in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, if you stay on your current path, you're not going to be happy like you think. Okay. What about long term? Do you want to keep on flipping houses and wholesaling houses like you are for the next 5, 10, 15 years? Most of you don't. Okay. It's an active income. Most of us are looking at passive income, and Daniel walks through how he's earning a little over about $30,000 a month in passive income right now. Okay. Actually $200,000 a year in passive income. Got my numbers a little bit mixed up there. He says it on the podcast, but about $200,000 in passive income just from his rental properties. He's also able to grow a multi-million-dollar tech company on the side and running $5 to $7 million in development projects all in Richmond, Virginia. Guys and gals, tune in on this episode up next. But what I want you to do, if you're interested in generating more online leads, content is a way to go. Here at Investor Carrot, the vast majority of our own customers are coming from our content marketing. So over 60% of the leads that our customers are bringing in, which is tens of thousands per month, are coming from content, coming from SEO and that content ranking. So how do you create content? How do you create the right content that's going to attract a motivated house seller, a cash buyer, a tenant, or if you're a real estate agent, a buyer or seller, how do you do that? How do you crack through the clutter in your market? Well, we have a free guide that we've put together for you that you guys can get. Just pick up your phone and dial to the phone number 38470, type in the word carrot. So send carrot to 38470 via a text message. Okay. So text the word carrot to 38470. Our system is then going to reply back and say, hey, what's your email address? We're going to then send you this guide on content marketing, which is going to give you a checklist, a full guide with a video walking through how we do content marketing, how you can do too. Cut through that clutter, gain more consistency and predictability, and grow your business. Without further ado, I want to introduce you to Daniel Clayman, one of my good friends, insanely high performing guy. He's getting married this fall. And one of the guys I really look up to that's legit in this industry, that's going out there and doing what he says, up and up, a guy on the up and up, and just crushing it in Richmond, Virginia with his real estate strategy. Let's go, guys and gals. Let's go ahead and dive in to this interview, this podcast with Daniel Clayman. And like I mentioned on the intro, I'm crazy excited about this call because Daniel, and I guess let me throw this out there first. So I've always called you Daniel, and you know that I call you Daniel. A lot of other people call you Daniel. Dude, is it what do you want people to call you?
Let's just make it easy. Daniel is fine. I'll take the easy way out. Just call me Daniel.
There we go. So guys and gals, Daniel.
I've been called much worse.
That's right. So Daniel Klayman, and I'm excited to have him on because him and I have been friends for, you know, 4, 5, 6 years now, and we're in a mastermind together. And it's been really cool seeing him grow.
We're in two masterminds together, maybe three.
Yeah, two masterminds together, which is way, way more than I ever wanted to see you per year, man. So,
thanks, buddy.
Just kidding. Oh, and first of all, two guys and gals, you can probably notice that you can't see my face in this podcast. I'm having some technical difficulties on my end, but at least you guys can see Daniel. So you won't be able to see my mug up there, which is cool. But so we've known each other for several years. It's been cool seeing your journey, you know, in your different businesses, you know, all the way from your real estate business, which is what we're going to talk about today, to your software company. It's the different things you're doing. And it's one thing that's always really impressed me. Like I pull back and go, man, how does he get so much done? Because it seems like you answer emails fast, which I don't, and I need to work on that. You answer emails fast, you get a lot done, and you just seem like you're always just crushing it. And I first,
thank you.
Yeah, well, you are. And I first go back to, I'm like, okay, well, he doesn't have kids, but you are getting married this fall.
No kids that I'm aware of.
Yeah, no kids that you're aware of. So that's part of it. But still, man, you're doing some stuff that makes you highly, highly effective in what you do. And I want to tap into that in this call in a little bit. But to kind of set the stage for people, just so they know, you know, what level of investor you are, kind of what you focus on. You've got a rental portfolio yourself of about 70 homes there. Are they all in Virginia?
Yeah, they're all in Richmond, in Virginia, yeah.
All in Richmond. And you're doing a lot of new construction right now. You've got a commercial project going right now that I've been seeing the posts on it in Facebook, which looks really cool. And you've got a bunch of new construction going on, duplexes and stuff like that. Dude, the first thing I'm going to ask you is how do you do all this? Like, do you have a team that helps you do this stuff, or do you just pound Russian vodka every day and hit the day off?
Yeah, dude, I just mainline coffee all day long. I mean, I was gonna make a joke that I don't sleep, but I actually sleep 8 hours a night.
Yeah.
And if I don't get my 8 hours, I'm cranky and unproductive the next day, which is very different from my 20s. But no, I mean, I've got a team, but I don't have a big company. You know, on the software side, we have 2 full-time employees. Everything else is outsourced. On the development side, I have a full-time property manager, and then everything else is subcontractors. So all of my construction projects, I'm the general contractor. I'm overseeing all the subs. I handle all of the development work. It takes time. I work a lot. I mean, I'm really fortunate because I love what I do. Otherwise I would have shot myself a long time ago, because this, you know, especially when you get into real estate development, and I'm not running a huge company. We're not doing a ton of projects at the same time. I mean, at any given time, I'm usually doing anywhere between 3 to 6 or 7 projects at a time at most. So, you know, it's not like I'm running a huge development company. You've probably had, you know, guys on your call that do far more deals than I do, but, I do enough to where I don't go insane. And I also do just enough to where I don't have to hire a big team, because the vision of my life doesn't involve managing 10, 20, 30 employees. That sounds like a nightmare to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
on you're in Richmond, and the people listen to this call, people listen to the Carrot Cast, or watching the video, which does not include me, just includes Daniel. So if you guys are just now tuning in, Daniel's the only one on this video portion. But so you're in Richmond, and one thing I've always been kind of fascinated with, and I have mentioned to you another friend of mine, Jason Duff, who I want to get on this Carrot Cast sometime soon. He's doing similar to what you're doing up in Ohio, and he's going to be buying up all these properties downtown, renovating them, just doing amazing things. And kind of what leaned you toward investing heavily in one market versus diversifying in a bunch of different areas? Because you're really heavily invested in Richmond, but one specific part of Richmond.
Yeah, I mean, I've never bought anything outside of my city, and most of my efforts have been focused on one area. And, you know, I don't know if it started out being strategic. I think I started out doing back in 2008, 2009, I started out buying properties kind of all over my city and getting a feel for them. And I still own a lot of those properties. But then I started asking myself, what area has the most potential going forward? Where is there the biggest potential for progress? And then part of it is just coolness. Like, I don't know, like I end up focusing all of my efforts in one area that I thought was located really strategically and just happened to be really cool. It has a lot of historical housing stock, beautiful architecture, a lot of character. And there were some other factors that really kind of contributed to me stepping up in one particular area, which included other investors similar to mine also investing in this particular area. But it's worked out, but it's just, I just as well could have bet. I mean, it's worked out phenomenally.
Yeah.
Right. But I just as well could have bet on the wrong area. Yeah. So like I'm selling off some properties they own in other parts of town that really haven't progressed in the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. I thought they were in the path of progress, but the area just never took off.
So I want to dive into some more of your strategy in the Richmond market, but let's kind of peel it back a little bit so people have a perspective for kind of where you came from. So how did you get to Richmond originally? Because I know you were up in Manhattan for years. Kind of what's your the last 10 years of your life? What does that look like?
Yeah, I was a corporate, highly paid corporate slave for a while. I worked in New York in finance, and I was there through 2008 when the market crashed. And when the market crashed, I could have gotten another job. I could have stayed in the industry, and I really decided I just didn't want to have a job anymore. I basically just said to myself, doesn't matter what kind of job I can rebound into and I can go and get, there is no job that I would be happy with. One of my mentors from earlier in my career basically taught me to really look at life. And when you're having a hard time making decisions, look at extreme examples, right? So ask yourself extreme questions. So when the market crashed and the company I was working for, which was Bear Stearns, it blew up. I got hired into JP Morgan. This was like late 2008. I worked at JP Morgan for a few months and I really just didn't like it anymore. And I was kind of pushing to get laid off and they finally laid me off.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to quit because I wanted a severance package. So finally, I think August 2008, they finally laid me off, gave me a nice severance package. And I walked home back to my like $3,000 a month, ridiculous Upper East Side apartment that I couldn't afford to pay for anymore because I got laid off. And I had to make a decision. Do I go out tomorrow and start and send out resumes and get another job? And I could have. I mean, I was coming from a really good place. I was coming from a good company. I had a decent reputation. I could have got another job somewhere at a hedge fund or another Wall Street bank. But I asked myself an extreme question. If somebody made me CEO with a multi-million dollar pay package tomorrow of a company that, you know, in New York, would I wake up excited for the next 3 months about going to work? And the answer was no. I just flat out didn't want to have a job anymore. I didn't want to be responsible to anybody else. I didn't want to have a set schedule. I didn't want to be trapped in an office or a cubicle. I didn't want to have to ride the subway at 7 o'clock in the morning wearing a suit. So I moved back to Virginia. I moved back to where my family was, and I already owned a couple of investment properties I owned passively with my friends here in town. And I just slowly started picking up some other houses, single family houses. I mean, they were dirt cheap, late 2008, early 2009. I wake up every morning just wishing that those days would come back. I mean, you could get properties for nothing. So it was just a no-brainer time to get into real estate, especially if you were focused on rentals at the time, because you could rent stuff. You can flip houses back in 2009, right? I mean, we were buying foreclosures for 20, 30, 40 grand, rehabbing them. There were no retail buyers at that time, but you could rent them.
Yeah.
Right. So if you bought the right product and you did just the right amount of work to it without overinvesting, but without making it shitty, you could rent it out and build a nice steady cash flow. And so my goal was simple when I started my real estate company. I just wanted to replace my salary that I was making in my job. I wanted my monthly cash flow from my real estate to reach what I was making every month at my old job. It was a very simple goal, right?
So how long did it take you to get there?
18 months to 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It took a little bit of time, but I had a little bit of money saved up. I had some severance and I massively lowered my living expenses.
Yeah.
And, it was a great time to get in. Can I cuss on your podcast?
Go for it, man.
Okay. So, I mean, the pure shit show that occurs now at like auctions and when properties hit MLS, right? I mean, we all know what's going on now in most markets. I mean, in my market, things are getting massively overbid. I skipped the tax auction a couple of days ago because I knew that was just going to be just a disaster, right? I mean, way too many buyers overpaying. Back in 08, 09, 2010, none of that was happening. I mean, you could pick up properties for pennies and a dollar. There was absolutely nobody else bidding against you. So it was a great time to get in. Mm-hmm. And it was a great time to accumulate a portfolio, especially an income-producing portfolio.
So we were talking about new construction a little bit earlier. Is that why you kind of dove into new construction? Because the existing properties were getting bid up so much, so expensive, and you're like, hey, there's land here. I can buy land and I can build new. Is that kind of what drove you in that direction, or was it something else?
Yeah, I started buying land a couple of years ago because it was still cheap, and I got to the point where I had some disposable income and I was making good money, and I could – What I didn't have back in 08, 09, when it was a no-brainer to buy land, you couldn't give land away back then. Yeah. You could offer a car for free with the land giveaway. Nobody would take it, right? But to buy land in an up market, it's good if you have patient money,
yeah,
right? Because land, until you develop land, it's not an income-producing asset. Right. And even if you buy land and you immediately initiate the development process, the development cycle is still going to be 6, 9, 12 months for residential. For commercial, it's usually longer. Construction is longer. Permitting process is longer. You may have to go through zoning variances. Right. So to buy land, you really need patient money. You need money that you can plug in and leave there in that land. And if I could go back to 08, 09 with a million or two in patient money.
Yeah.
Oh my God, dude. I'd be talking to you from, no, I'd still be in the same place where I live now, but you get my point, right? I'd be in a different place. Mm. So 2-3 years ago, I got to the point where I had patient money and I started picking up some lots because I really wasn't able to buy enough investment properties with my disposable cash,
yeah,
right? With my funds. And I saw where the market was headed. I saw that retail sales were increasing. I saw that home price appreciation in my market was going up. And I knew that it would be right eventually to develop these to sell to owner occupants. And then some lots I knew would be perfect to develop into rental properties. And now it's just as hard to buy lots as it is to buy houses, because again, the cat is out of the bag. And I mean, you and I are partly responsible for this, right? We have info businesses and we cater to real estate investors. And so we brought a lot of new people into the market,
yeah, yeah,
and created investors out of them where they were maybe doing something else before. So
what's next, do you think, in the market? I know that's something I'm thinking about a lot on our end, because about 18 months ago, I was looking at, you know, with CARAT as an example, I was looking at it and going, okay, the way that market trends go, you know, here eventually within 18 months, it's going to get really hard for your average house flipper or wholesaler to do a deal. There's still tons of deals out there.
Yeah.
Tons of deals out there. But the person who's not willing to work their butts off and actually create a real consistent, scalable business is going to have a hard time. So then what happens there is your real estate agents, they're like, oh my gosh, I can make money just selling any house out there. Like any agent with a pulse pretty much can make money now. And that's the phase that we're in. So
yeah,
a lot of those people who were agents and investors, they're going back to the agent side. And so we're kind of looking at, and we pretty much have a really good feeling where the market's going to go the next, as an aggregate, you know, in the next 12 to 24 months. What's your feeling there in Richmond? Like, is it something that you're going, oh my gosh, I got to focus on now commercial? Is that one way you're going to tie it down, or just making sure you're buying right and not over leveraging?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just focused on stocking my development pipeline for the next 2 years, basically, which I've already done. Like, I've bought enough land to where I have enough to keep me busy.
Yeah.
To develop, and we're still finding deals. You can still find deals, but you really have to be a lot more methodical about it. I haven't even looked at MLS in 2 years. I don't even remember what the MLS interface looks like, right? Like that's, you know, tax auctions used to be amazing. Now they're a joke, right? I still source a lot of deals from wholesalers. I don't do a lot of my own marketing, but to keep filling my development pipeline, I'm going back to doing a lot of my own targeted mailing campaigns that I'm going to launch this fall.
Okay.
But my primary sources so far for the last 18 months have been wholesalers and a few mailing campaigns that I've done and just networking, right? So you can still find really good deals. You just have to turn over a lot more stones. And my focus is really just on buying enough land to fill my development pipeline for the next 18 to 24 months. And really, I've pulled back in terms of buying physical assets. Like, I haven't bought a house or a building in 18 months.
Yeah.
Right. I'm just buying land that at prices where I know I can develop it and make money. And I have between what I have in my pipeline that I'm getting ready to break ground on the next 10 to 18 months, it's about $9 to $10 million in projects.
Okay.
Right. So like, and out of that, there's going to be a large mixed use commercial building. That's a big chunk of that development that I'm really focused on. And then 8-unit apartment building, 4-unit apartment building, and a bunch of single family houses that I'm going to sell if the market continues to go where I think it's going to go.
Yeah.
But I see a lot of my friends, that have taken the same growth and same sort of evolution as me, they've done the same. They've pulled back from the crazy acquisitions and acquisition rate at which we were going in the past. And we're all much more selective about what we buy. Would rather do less deals, make sure they're solid deals. I'm actually, a lot of my older assets, not a lot, a chunk of my older assets, I just put in the market and I'm going to sell. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much 1031 money out there chasing deals.
Yep.
Right now. And there's so much investor money chasing deals. I'm taking a bunch of duplexes that I bought back in like 06, 07, the very beginning, and I'm putting them on the market just to test the market. And if I can hit the right numbers, I'm gonna take my profits.
Do you feel your market's nearing a correction, or do you feel it's still gonna keep on marching forward, or?
No, we're not in the correction. The market is very hot right now. I've got 6 houses that we just built that we're selling in the neighborhood where I've really been focused. Yeah. And we're continually pushing the dollar per square foot up. Yeah. I mean, I got a house closing tomorrow that should be, if my data is correct, should be a new high for the market.
Oh, wow.
In terms of dollar per square foot for new construction. Mm-hmm. And so, no, we're not in the correction. The market is still very hot, but the paranoid side of me always says it can't last. We all know it can't last. So the question really then becomes, how long will it last? How big the correction will be? I don't think the correction will be anything like what we saw in 2008.
Yeah.
I think as long as the interest rates stay down, I think this, again, I can only speak about my market. I don't know what's going on in Oregon or Alabama or wherever you live, Trevor. Like, yeah. No idea, right? But I think in my market, we may continue to be hot for a year or two, as long as interest rates stay down and as long as investor money keeps going into the market and as long as owner-occupants continue buying. But I'm very careful about building more than a few spec houses at a time. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to get stuck.
Yep.
Right? So, I mean, we build 3, 4, 6... boom, get these under contract. Now I'm not breaking ground on anything else until spring. If the market is still hot, I'm going to break ground on 2 or 3 in the spring. And it's enough to keep me fed, right? It's just, so.
So a couple questions. So earlier you mentioned that the tax auctions are crazy. You know, people are buying properties for really crazy amounts. So your background in finance, and of course your software is a deal analyzing software. So How has your background in finance served you as an investor, and kind of what can those guys, even if some of them are listening to this podcast, like those guys at the tax auctions that thinks that, that the market's just going to keep crushing, what do they need to do differently? Like, why are they thinking they're good deals, but you're looking at it from your background and going, man, those aren't.
Honestly, I looked at the last tax auction. I looked at the prices at which some properties sold. My only explanation is that people are either just inexperienced or over optimistic about the future, like you said, which is the same stupid mistake everybody made back in 05, 06, 07 when they were buying not based on cash flow, but based on potential appreciation, yep, right? And potential rent growth. I think it's also people are underestimating repairs, right? I mean, there were a few properties that sold that, you know, the after repair value is going to be maybe $160 a foot, and it's going to take $80 a foot to rehab these things, and they were paying $100 a foot.
Oh wow!
Or $90 a foot, right? Try doing that math.
Yep, it doesn't work out.
No, it's crazy. It doesn't work. So it may be not just that people are inexperienced, but specifically people are inexperienced in they're underestimating how much work certain properties are going to take. Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. So people who are listening to this, make sure if you guys are going to the tax auctions, your market's hot or whatever it is, if you guys are going out there, make sure you pull back and go, okay, let's really look at our numbers. Let's make sure that we're dialing this in. Is this really a good deal? And I think the key, like you mentioned, are we betting on appreciation, or are we betting on something that doesn't currently exist in that house?
I think that's what a lot of people are doing now, and especially like this 1031 money. I don't know if everybody in your call understands what 1031 is, but the 1031 exchange is basically what people do when they sell investment properties, and then they can reinvest it within a certain period of time into similar investment properties and avoid having to pay capital gains taxes, right? It's a very common sort of wealth building strategy, but there is a lot of people right now that are buying real estate. We're starting to see same thing happen that happened back in like 06, 07. People are buying not based on current performance, based on current numbers, but they're buying based on what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to sell to those people.
That's right. I love it. Yeah, exactly. It's Daniel's secret, guys and gals. Daniel's secret.
That's so right.
If you guys have some 1031.
Don't show this. Don't let anybody from Richmond download this podcast. Can you do something on your?
I'm sure we can do some sort of location something. We'll figure that out.
Block all the IPs or something. I don't know.
Man, one thing you mentioned earlier, which I really love, so you mentioned something that your one of your mentors told you way back when, to think about the extreme examples of something, and that way that you made your decision from staying in Manhattan and continuing on that path versus moving down was mm-hmm. awesome. And I think a lot of people listening to this call can probably put themselves in that those shoes and go, okay, I need to ask myself that example. Dude, what recently that you can remember have you asked yourself that, and how has that shifted a big decision that you've recently made or not made?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, it's not very often in life that you make sort of huge pivotal moves like that. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know.
That's cool. If you haven't asked it recently, that's cool. I was kind of curious, but if not, that's awesome. So what was the specific question, and so people can write it down, because like I said, it was really, really good.
Well, we have to make decisions every day, right? And we tend to think about decisions and our choices in terms of a certain limit, right? And that limit is within sort of the realm of possibilities. So should I not eat breakfast, or should they eat breakfast, right? Or what kind of breakfast should they have? Or, I mean, when it comes to real life decisions, it's more of, you know, should I start a business or should they not risk starting a business, right? It becomes much easier to make decisions if you expand sort of your possible choices and possible scenarios of what can happen in life beyond what will likely happen, right? So if you're asking yourself, should I start a business and your realm of possibility is that you're either going to fail or you'll make $100,000. Well, it doesn't seem that exciting to start a business, right? But you know, ask yourself, what if something amazing happens and this business blows up to $10 million a year or $100 million a year? Is it worth it? And is it worth taking that risk, right? Well, then the answer is easy. Of course it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Right. So think in terms of extreme examples. I think it makes decision making a lot easier.
And dude, on the flip side of it too, you'll talk to a lot of house wholesalers or house flippers, and where they'll say, hey, you know, once they're doing 5, 10, 15, 20 deals a month for the big guys, I mean, they're doing a real business, man. It's like it's the grind. You're not collecting this passive income unless you build an amazing team. So even if you're going to start house flipping or wholesaling, or you already are, that extreme example question is great. You know, what happens if I get to 10 or 20 or 30 deals a month or mm-hmm. deals a year, whatever it is? Is that a business I want to grow? And if that is a business you want to grow, what do you have to do now to make sure you're setting it up to where it's going to serve your life and serve what you want to do in your life, serve your purpose and your mission? And that's one thing I'll do quite a bit is I'll ask like a worst case scenario question. And mm-hmm. I don't know, that's the way my mind works a lot. I know Tony Robbins talks about that people go toward pleasure or away from pain.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know, man, it's kind of funny, but I usually am more motivated by going away from pain, and which is funny, but because I'm a really positive guy. But when I think of worst case scenarios yeah. get me more fired up about, man, I don't want that. Or maybe that's not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Well, and it's good for planning, right? I think, and that's probably another example of applying this sort of thinking, right? This probably will not happen, but are we prepared for it if it does happen, right? What's the absolute worst that can happen? And are we prepared to handle it? That's more of a conversation that I have with like my property manager, right? When we're looking at certain issues or how to deal with a certain tenant, you know, I'll say to him, well, what if that happens, right? Are we prepared to deal with it? And why don't we do something now while we're here doing it to make sure that the extreme doesn't happen, even if we don't think that it'll happen. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally, man. I was talking with a guy here in Roseburg. This guy, he is an amazing craftsman, man. Like he made these bookshelves for us here, just these amazing reclaimed bookshelves with this industrial looking metal. And he's just a really, really cool dude. And he's had a full-time job in this thing on the side. And he was coming in here to our, you know, to the loft, our entrepreneur co-workspace. He's like, man, mm-hmm. I'm just tired of my job. I've worked it for 7 years, you know, worked for Dish or whatever, and AT&T bottom, and just has been not a very good place to work. And he was mm-hmm. teeter-tottering back and forth on whether he should take a chance to start his own company. And he had a pretty good clientele going, has great products people love. And I did the worst-case scenario question with him. I'm like, dude, so what's the worst-case scenario if you continue on? Or even what's the best-case scenario if you continue on with your job?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I might make a little bit more money. Like I might get a raise. They just cut our pay 30% last year, but I might get a raise. I'll probably still be miserable because the company that bought us is just not treating us well. So best-case scenario, I'll keep having a paycheck, but I'll probably not be happy. Worst-case, I might be fired or just completely miserable and hate doing us. Okay, what's on the flip side? What if you start your own company? Worst case, best case. And his worst case wasn't that bad. It's like, well, I will be doing work that I enjoy doing every day. Let's say I can't sell stuff and then I've got to go back and get a job again. It's like, okay, that's your worst. And you're single, you don't have kids, dude. Do it.
Yeah.
You know.
And actually, for the 4-hour work week, he talked about something very similar, right? Tim Ferriss prescribed doing that same type of analysis, right? Where, okay, you're going to start a business. It seems risky. What's the worst thing that can happen? All right, you're going to spend a year doing something that's not going to work out. You're going to fail. Your parents will think you're a failure. Your friends will think you're a failure. Your girlfriend will probably think you're a failure. That's probably the worst case scenario. And then the worst thing that's going to happen is you may have to go back and look for a job after a year. Well, when you're sitting there in a job interview, again, we're talking about worst case scenario, right? You're sitting there in a job interview and is there going to be a gap in your resume? Well, not really. You're going to be sitting across the table from somebody and they're going to say, well, looks like your last job was a year ago. What have you been doing for the past year? And you're going to tell them, well, I started a business. I learned the following skills. It didn't work out, but here's all the things that I did for the past year. Like, that's actually going to allow you to go and get a better job than what you have now anyway.
Yeah.
No, that's your worst case scenario. I mean, what hiring manager is going to sit across from the table from you if you have to go get another job and look down at you for attempting to be an entrepreneur, even if it didn't work out, right? Yeah. It's a no-brainer.
It is, man. And I'll kind of wrap up this little thread here with this, that oftentimes I'll look at it going, you know, what is the worst that can happen or the best that could happen if I don't make this decision? You know, what if I don't start this company? What if I don't do this? What's my life going to be like in 5 or 10 years? And usually that's what gets me. It's like, you know what? I don't want that. So I got to do something for sure. So guys and gals, if you're in that point where you guys are coming up with the tough decision, ask the question that Daniel's mentor mentioned to him, and also look at the worst case scenario and best case scenario and see, and that'll probably make things look a lot easier for you. Dude, one thing I saw, I can't remember if we were talking about it or if it was me stalking your Facebook or something like that, dude, but you mentioned something about you sat down for dinner with a really, really, really wealthy person sometime in the last 4, 5, 6 months. And the guy said that he used to have the mansion, used to have all the fancy stuff, but now lives in a little apartment and they're happier now. And that's one thing that, and I may have got some of it wrong, but that was the paraphrase of what I remember. And first of all, kind of what are some of the big lessons you learned from that guy? I don't know how well you know him, but it seemed like you guys at least hit it off. And second, I know you do extremely well. You do multiple millions a year in your different businesses, and you don't have this big, lavish lifestyle. So what for you has really helped keep you grounded and help you focus on being happy instead of this flashy thing that makes other people happy?
Yeah. So the guy owns like 3,000 units. He's a very well-known local developer, and he's much older. He's in his 60s or 70s. But his career is basically what I want to emulate, at least in terms of growth and assets. And he's done very well for himself. And kids moved out of the house, went to college, married, whatever. And he and his wife sold their huge mansion. They moved into a nondescript 1200 square foot condo, in like a crappy, it's not even a good condo building. It's like an old crappy condo building. And man, I have so much freaking respect for that. It's unbelievable, right? I mean, here's a guy that just couldn't give two shits about what people think. Yep. It's awesome. And I've always believed in that. I don't like things. Like, I don't really buy things. My cars are old as shit. I'm going to stop cussing. People are going to unsubscribe from your podcast. Who is this rude Russian that you brought on?
The can of worms, man. It's out anyways. You're good.
Yeah, but my cars are like 7 or 8 years old. I've paid them off ages ago. I live, at least for now. I mean, look, this is going to change. I'm getting married. She wants a bigger place. You know, the ball chain. But up until now, I've succeeded at like not owning anything. Right? I can pick up tomorrow and literally just, you know, like, if you're watching the video, the books behind me are probably the most valuable thing I own, right? Dude, it's my life.
I'm going to take a shot of this right here, and I'm going to superimpose the Lamborghini behind you. You're the Russian Ty Lopez.
The books, that's right. Put some gold chains around me, bro.
That's
bling,
right.
Bling.
No, but seriously.
No, but like I can move tomorrow with a couple of boxes, right? I live actually, super, funny enough, in a 1,200 square foot apartment in a building that I own. And I get paid to live here. There's 4 units here. The other 3, after I collect their rent, they pay for mortgage, real estate taxes, insurance, maintenance, utilities, and they still have $1,000 left over. So instead of paying to live here, I get paid to live here.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah, I mean, that's like, I've never, like, I don't buy expensive clothes. I like watches, so occasionally I'll buy a nice watch, right? Like a nice Swiss watch. That's like the only thing ever that I spend money on in terms of material things. But at the same time, I travel a lot. I spend money on experiences. I will never hesitate to spend money on experiences. That is far more valuable. I mean, we've been out of the country four times already this year. And we stay in nice hotels. We go to nice places. We go out to eat a lot. So it doesn't mean I'm living like a pauper. I'm not a complete minimalist, but I'd much rather spend money on experiences than just keep accumulating junk and crap that is just going to clog up your life. I see so many people do that, and like gadgets. Like, dude, I barely know how to use my iPhone. I don't use any apps. It like makes calls and sends texts. Yeah. Occasionally I take pictures with it. Like, I see people buy all these latest gadgets and new phones and laptops. Like, I run a multi-million dollar software business off of a laptop with one screen.
Yeah. It's so funny because I hope people who are listening to this, I know you got to go here in about 5 minutes or so, so we'll wrap it up. But I know people, I hope people who are listening to this kind of capture on to what we've been talking about the last few minutes here. And it's really important, man, because I know back in the day when I first got started and wanting to be an entrepreneur, you kind of get latched on, you kind of get hooked in by that stuff, right? You're like, okay, first of all, let's get our bills paid for so I don't have to get a job and so my back's not against the wall. And then let me go get that, you know, I want to maybe go get that cool thing or whatever. A lot of people do. I never was. But once you get the cool thing, you know, you hear from people who got their Lamborghini or they got their whatever it is. And after 2, 3, 4 months, the newness goes away and they're like, well, now I've got this $400,000 car in my thing and I kind of look cool and that's about it. And
it's a trap. Dude, it's all a trap. I think it's also like to a degree, to be fair, it's a function of where you live, right? I live in a very laid back, non-flashy town and where I really don't feel any peer pressure, any pressure to compete with anybody. I mean, if you're living in Miami or LA and you travel within certain social circles, especially if you cater to clients, right? I mean, there's certain situations where I can understand buying a really nice car, living in a really nice flashy place. There are certain situations where I can see myself doing that as well. But like, I live in a very laid back town where people don't really flash their wealth. Nobody really cares.
Yeah.
If anything, it's viewed as ostentatious.
Do you find the more stuff that you accumulate, the more each one of those things, even subconsciously, kind of like gets mind space from you?
No, because I don't accumulate anything, and I'm lucky because my fiance is the same way. She hates stuff. Like, we purposely didn't have a wedding registry because my worst nightmare is having to leave the wedding with like a crate full of.
Dude,
shit,
dude. Wait.
I wake up in cold sweat over that.
Wait till you have kids and the birthday parties. You're gonna have to lay out the ground rules to the grandparents and stuff. And we've had to do the same thing where, you know, our parents love our kids to death and they think that they've always got to give them these things. And we're like, about 2 years ago we said, you know what? They don't need more toys. All that happens, that toy that you gave is as much love that came with it. You gave it for yourself. The kid could give a crap because they like the box.
They'll forget about it tomorrow.
They like the box better, but you gave it for yourself. And that's not a bad thing, but how can we help to mold the people around us and ourselves to giving things that matter versus giving things that are a token of our appreciation? Let's give them our love and give them an experience. And that's what we've kind of been doing with our parents lately is they've
been that's smart.
Amazing job taking our kids out and doing things with them as their gifts. And like, that's perfect. So we don't have to take it home. We don't have to accumulate it. And then the kids end up connecting with their grandparents even more. So,
yeah, or just go and give all that crap to charity. Yeah. I mean, I've been lucky so far that, you know, my life in terms of possessions is very simple, but yeah, I mean, once you have a family, I mean, it gets more complicated. So,
couple more questions. Like actually one quick one, then I'll let you get going.
Yeah.
3 minutes here. So, on the real estate side, once again, you talked about, you're really in an accumulation mode as far as getting properties you're going to be holding and things like that. Kind of for your long-term strategy, do you have a certain number, and you don't have to tell me that number, but do you have a certain number where you're going to stop? Do you have a number where you're like, you know what, once I get this many units, then we're going to be good and I'm going to do something else?
Yeah, I think that number is going to be lower than I probably have ever thought. It's easy to start off and say, yeah, I want to own 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 units. But I've been very careful about how I grow and what I accumulate. I mean, if you really think about it, 70 units, and they have another probably 50 units in development right now, right? But 70 units accumulated over last seven years, it's not that much. It's not hard. But that 70 units for me cash flows clean. Now, again, after I pay my property manager, after I pay all of my expenses, and after I put away 15% of gross rent roll into reserves and for maintenance,
yep.
That 70 units still cash flows over 200 grand a year.
Yeah.
Right? So I'll triple it, and like how much more do I need? Like, I don't even know, like, what am I going to do with that money? So, but what I don't want is for every, I'm basically ballparking for every 100 units, I'm going to need an additional property management employee.
Yeah.
And so I really don't see myself managing a large company, right? And even at 1,000 units, I'll probably need a staff of 12 to 15 people to realistically run that portfolio. So I think in reality, I would much rather have 200 or 300 really solid, high-end, easy-to-manage units. And they alone, forget my other businesses, they alone can provide me and my family with the kind of life that I'll never need anything. You know, I'll be able to take a chunk of that money and actually reinvest it back into other things.
And that's what I was going to ask last is, you know, once you get to that point, because you will, I mean, you're on that path and you're a young dude. Once you get to that point, do you kind of deep down know what's next? Is it taking that money? And you've already started investing in startups, which is really cool. You're going to do more of that?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Maybe invest in startups. I mean, right now I'm really more focused on growing my software business. But if I ask myself what I'm truly passionate about, it is actually like large scale development.
Yeah.
So now, and that conflicts with what I just told you, right? Because I don't necessarily want to own and manage a ton of units. But if I ask myself, what really gets me juiced up? Like, what gets me just really excited every morning? It's developing communities, right? It's building, putting up buildings from the ground up, from scratch, where nothing was before. It's architectural design. It's layout design. Like, we're working on a mixed use project right now that's just awesome. It's going to have restaurants, office, retail, apartments, rooftop, event space. It's that kind of projects that really get me excited, right? Like, I want to buy like 16 acres and build a huge mixed use community there with condos, apartments, retail, offices, like that kind of stuff. You know, doing something where you're really shaping how hundreds and thousands of people will live, work, and play for decades to come. Like, that's what gets me really excited. So again, I know it conflicts with me saying I don't want to own a ton of assets, right? But maybe that future involves building the stuff and selling it.
Yep.
Right. Or
and dude, that's where I was going right there. We're gonna finish with this right here. I love when people find not just their passion, but what it is that ties what it is that they at their core are so excited about growing their business for other than money. Because as you know, dude, once you get to a certain spot with your business and money, that drive completely goes away and actually can be a demotivator. And I've experienced that. I don't know if you have, but once you get to that point, you've got to have something deep down in your core that drives you at continuing to run the business and continuing to want to grow it. And that right there nailed it for you, dude. So you'll have your 200 units or whatever it is that's going to take care of your money side of it. You're going to keep on doing developments, which are going to be awesome. But then your full motivation then is making people happy, building amazing communities, having the satisfaction that you know that you can walk into a place that 10 years ago wasn't teeming with life. Now it is. And you're just really bettering people's worlds. And that's a big deal, man. So I love it. I love it, man. And that's your mission. I want people to go out there. And if you guys don't have your own missions, if you don't know what at your core ties you to why you want to continue growing, continue doing your business, you need to find it. And I go out there and shout it to the rooftops. Think about it every day and find ways you can build that into your business. So you're not looking back 10 years from now and going, man, I've got a lot of money, but I'm really miserable. I've been there. Don't want to do it again.
Yeah, it can't. Yeah, it can't be just about money. It's once your needs are satisfied and you've bought enough trinkets and toys, you'll just burn out. It can't be about that.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right.
I appreciate the heck out of it. What's your favorite book behind you? Last question.
What's my favorite book behind me? I just read a couple of really good books, actually. I read a book called Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday.
Oh, yep. Yep.
Excellent book. I just read a really good book called Living with a Seal.
That's a good one.
Awesome book. Yeah, I mean, I'm just last three books that I read in the last like couple of weeks, and because I have them all stacked in order, and I read a really good book on negotiating. I don't have it on my shelf back there, but it's by a former FBI hostage negotiator, Chris. Oh God, the book is called Never Split the Difference. Negotiate as if your life depended on it. It's by Chris Voss, V-O-S-S, okay. Is the name of the guy, Chris Voss. And the guy spent decades working as an FBI hostage negotiator and wrote a book on negotiation strategy that really can be applied to anything, not just hostage negotiations, but business, negotiating your salary, negotiating with at a farmer's market on a Saturday, right? And the whole premise is that he doesn't really believe in win-win. Yeah. He thinks win-win is bullshit. And the book basically teaches how to negotiate through empathy, but yet empathize with people, but still walk away with exactly what you want instead of splitting the difference with them and meeting them in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Very, very good book of negotiation.
I love it, man. I love it. Well, I'll let you keep going. I know you got to go, but I appreciate the heck out of you carving this 45 minutes out.
Yeah, bro.
And us connecting, because we usually don't get a chat about this kind of stuff except for at the masterminds and whatnot. So get on with the rest of your day. Guys and gals, where can they find you? Where can they find out more about you or follow you?
Go to rehabvalue.com. If you're in real estate, go sign up for our software. We have a free version. It's an awesome, awesome program for wholesalers, house flippers, brokers. If you go to rehabvalutor, or actually Trevor is probably going to have a link somewhere, guessing.
Just go straight there. Go straight there.
Okay.
Yep.
So go to rehabvalutor.com, sign up for the free version of our software. I will help you with deal analysis, deal marketing, save you a ton of money, save you a ton of mistakes and time. And then you'll get emails from me and you'll be on my email list and you can just reply to any of those emails and you can get in touch with me directly.
Perfect. Awesome, dude. Have a great rest of the day, guys and gals.
All right, Trevor.
Thanks for tuning in. You can go ahead and bounce out of here to Neil if you want to, but thanks for tuning in, guys and gals, on this episode of the Carrot Cast. So what do you think, guys? What do you think? Is your business model one that's going to scale with you, one that's going to help build toward your dream, toward your mission, or is it one that's kind of churn and burn right now? And there's nothing wrong with having a churn and burn business model as long as that business model, that active income business model like house flipping or wholesaling, leads into a bigger end game, leads into fulfilling your mission. Okay. So if you guys don't have a what's next after your wholesale deals, if you guys don't have a what's next, if you're just building this business, is churning through tons of deals, that's great. But the majority of house flippers and wholesalers I talk to, they use that as a way to then acquire real estate so they can gain true freedom, gain true financial and time freedom with passive investments, with passive income, just like Daniel mentioned in this call. So look at the way that you've been investing. Look at the way you've been growing your business. Are you tackling it with a very methodical and planned approach for the long term, or are you just trying to churn some deals right now? Okay, think about that. Also, are you one of the people who's showing up to those auctions or showing up to whatever it is and paying way too much for deals? Are you getting caught up in the hype of the hot market right now and paying way too much? If you are, hopefully you remember 2008, 2009, have flashbacks to that. And it kind of scares you a little bit to be a lot more cautious. Okay. Work your numbers more tightly. Go over to Daniel's website to rehabvaluator.com. They have an amazing valuation tool over there that's going to help you make sure you're not paying too much. Okay. So the people who are going to get caught during this hot cycle are the people who are betting, just like Daniel mentioned, betting on things that do not currently exist in that property. They're betting on appreciation and price. They're betting on the ability to increase rents. Instead of using the current numbers, being smart and conservative with your rehab estimates, being smart and conservative with your prices, not betting on appreciation, but betting on cash flow. And those are the people who are going to win out. So hopefully you're in that bucket. On a future episode, we're actually prepping for one right now with a good friend of mine, Brad Chandler. Brad's the CEO and co-founder of Express Home Buyers out of Virginia and Washington, D.C. They're one of the top home buying companies in the country. I'm talking well over 2,000 deals. I think they're up close to 2,500 or 3,000 houses purchased now. And they have an operation. I mean, they have a full operation, full staff. They do tons of deals. We actually helped them with a bunch of their online marketing for a period of time. We still work with them. And they are a very sophisticated marketing engine. And we're going to get Brad on to talk about how you scale up from doing a couple deals a month or 5 deals a month or 10 deals a month to a multi-million dollar operation. How do you do that without going insane? How do you do that without making yourself feel like you're just going crazy because you have all this staff, all these deals? How do you do it to actually gain more freedom? So you can go out there and golf, or you can go to your son's golf tournaments like Brad does quite often. You can go travel. It can be done. Brad's done it. We're going to walk through how he's gone through that journey to become one of the top house buyers in the country and build an amazing business in the process. We're going to talk about mindset. We're going to hopefully stretch your mindset on that call. This isn't going to be a call on how to write up a contract. Okay. This is going to be mindset stuff. We're going to stretch you guys and help up level the way you think about life. Look out for that episode of the Carrot Cast. And you can get that episode 2 weeks early if you subscribe to us on iTunes. Just go over to iTunes, search for Carrot Cast, and subscribe to us over there, because we release all of our Carrotcast episodes 2 weeks early on iTunes versus on our blog. So if you want to listen to that episode as soon as it comes out, which will probably be here in the next few weeks, on iTunes, check it out over there. Okay. Or you can wait on our email list there, but please give us ratings, reviews, and subscribe on iTunes. It helps us get the word out to more people. And if you guys need any help yourselves with generating leads online, just like we've helped with Brad and their company, thousands of others, check us out at oncarrot.com and see if we're a fit. No other sales pitch needed right there. Just check us out. We're here for you. Have an amazing rest of the week, guys and gals. Check out the rest of the episodes of the Carrot Cast and make sure you've locked in your strategy, so you're protected during this hot cycle, so you're not going to be caught with your shorts down when prices correct a little bit. And make sure you're not the guy out there at those auctions that the experienced investors are looking at and going, man, those guys are paying way too much for their deals. Okay, go out there, guys and gals, get smarter with your numbers, and have an amazing rest of the week.